Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. I'm Jack Brighton, in for your regular host, David Inge. Over the next hour or so, we'll hear a pre-recorded interview with N.R. Narayanamurthy, Chairman of the Board and Chief Mentor at Infosys Technologies in Bangalore, India. Mr. Murthy was visiting the campus of the University of Illinois on September 14th to give the 21st Arnold O. Beckman Lecture in Science and Innovation, an event held this year at the Fullinger Auditorium on the campus of the University of Illinois. The topic of Mr. Murthy's Beckman Lecture and of the interview you're about to hear was the Indian software industry, managing change and growth in the knowledge economy. Mr. Murthy's visit to our campus was sponsored by the Coordinated Science Laboratory, and the Beckman Lecture is supported by the Center for Advanced Study, the Office of the Chancellor, the Research Board, the College of Business, and the College of Engineering. The lecture was very well attended, as Mr. Murthy is well known as one of the founders of India's software industry. A bit more about our guest, N.R. Narayanamurthy was among the first computer engineers to graduate from the U.S. AID program at the Indian Institute of Technology in the 1960s. He co-founded Infosys in 1981 and served as its CEO for 25 years. He's credited with a number of innovations, including introducing stock options to his employees, and he created millionaires at all levels of his company. His many recognitions and awards include World Entrepreneur of the Year in 2003 by Ernst & Young, Asia's 2003 Businessman of the Year by Fortune Magazine, and he was named by Time Magazine in 2004 as one of the top 10 most influential leaders shaping technology. This is, again, a pre-recorded interview, so we can't take your calls on the air during this hour. You started Infosys in 1981 with a total of 7 employees and about $250 American in financing. What was your vision for the company? What did you hope to create?
Well, you know, right from day one, we wanted to become the most respected company in India. At that time, of course, now we say we want to be the most respected company in the world. We wanted to add value to our customers in a unique way. We wanted to attract the best and the brightest professionals to work for Infosys. And we wanted to follow the finest principles of corporate governance. Those were really the major objectives when we started out.
An Infosys press release states the company defines, designs, and delivers IT-enabled business solutions. Some people will hear that and understand what it means, but many of our listeners won't have a clue. Can you help explain it for those people in non-IT terms and maybe give us an example of the kind of work you do?
Well, you know, basically what we do is we go to a customer organization, we study their business, and then we make a recommendation as to how their business can become more efficient, more productive, more profitable by our designing and implementing a solution based on the information technology instruments available in the market. And, for example, we have designed stock exchange systems. We have designed merchandising systems. You know, we have designed customer service systems, order processing systems. In each one of these cases, what has happened is the company has gotten better value for money from those investments. The company has gotten, has become more efficient, has enabled more customers, has become more profitable, has reduced cycle time, etc.
So clients would be banks and institutions.
Oh, yes.
And all over the world at this point.
Oh, yes, yes. We operate in all the G7 countries, plus in all about 40 countries.
Mm-hmm. The company Infosys is clearly growing very quickly, as is the Indian software industry. What is the impact of this growth on India and its economy?
Well, you know, last year we grew by 52%. The industry as a whole grew by 30%. One, it has created a large number of jobs. In other words, it has created an opportunity for educated middle-class youngsters to get high disposable income jobs. With the result, it has, you know, it has accelerated the growth of the secondary and the tertiary economies, that is, restaurants and, you know, other places. Second, I think the success of companies like Infosys, to the extent that it has created a lot of confidence in literally millions of youngsters, saying that, look, if these people could do it, we too can do. In other words, entrepreneurship has become fashionable. More and more youngsters are becoming entrepreneurs. That is good for a country because that's how you make the country more prosperous. So I would say those are the impact. Those are the impacts on India.
How do you answer the question, how have you been so successful? Does India have certain advantages in such an enterprise? And what are some of the unique elements of your approach to corporate governance in the software industry that have contributed to Infosys' success?
First of all, India has several advantages. One, the large number of English-speaking, technically trained graduates who come in at very affordable salaries. Second, India is anywhere between 9.5 hours to 12.5 hours with respect to United States, which means that we can combine the prime time of the U.S. with prime time of India to get what we call 24-hour workday, which means we can compress cycle time. Third, because right from day one, India accepted the dual economy model, that's the public sector and the private sector model, the Indian youngsters, unlike the Chinese youngsters, understand business. You know, they have gotten trained in project management. They understand virtual team operation. So I would say these are some of the advantages. On the issue of corporate governance, we at Infosys believe that if you want to make $1 million, you can shortchange a customer and make that money. But on the other hand, if you want to make $1 billion, then you have to run your company in the old-fashioned way, that's the right way. You cannot shortchange anybody. I define corporate governance as maximizing shareholder value while ensuring fairness to all our stakeholders, that is, customers, employees, vendor partners, you know, government of the land, investors, and the society. In other words, you have to be fair, you have to be transparent with all these stakeholders.
I understand that you have a very distinct philosophy toward employees, that it's something that is, as you mentioned, all these other stakeholders, the employee stakeholder is very, very important to
the
company.
Sure. You know, I often say that our primary set walks out at 5 o'clock in the evening, mentally and physically tired. It is our responsibility to ensure that that asset walks in bright, energetic, enthusiastic to serve our customers in the best possible manner. And the only way we can create that enthusiasm in the minds of our employees is by making sure that they are active partners in the business, by making sure that it's a meritocracy, by making sure that there is transparency, by making sure that there is openness, by making sure that everybody sees a value in our vision, everybody sees the rainbow that we are painting and believes that he or she can catch a part of it and put it in their pocket. In other words, we have to ensure that this talent is highly enthusiastic, energetic, and optimistic about the future of the company.
How do you go about doing that?
Well, first of all, of course, there are hygiene factors like decent salary, all of that, work environment, etc. But there are other factors, like you must protect the respect and dignity of each individual. You must ensure that there is full meritocracy. you must ensure that there are no biases in any decision making. In fact, at Infosys, we have a saying, and that is, in God we trust, everybody else brings data to the table. Every transaction is judged on the basis of the data, on the basis of the merit, so that people know that even if they lost the current transaction because they did not have proper data, they did not have merit in the current transaction, they still can win the next transaction. Then you have to ensure that everybody understands where they will end up 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now in the organization, what kind of responsibilities they would have. In other words, they should know their career profile. Then, of course, we have to ensure that there is, you know, very, very interesting and challenging work opportunity in the workplace. These are some of the things that we do.
How important is corporate and personal ethics in securing long-term success, and how do you approach this at Infosys?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, ethical behavior is what begets trust. Ethical behavior is what makes the other person confident of walking the marathon with you. Ethical behavior, in some sense, is the protocol that ensures that others in the team feel excited about you. So if we want to achieve any progress, then we have to enhance the trust, the confidence, and the optimism of other team members. And there's nothing more important for that than ethical behavior. Ethics, as you know, is beyond the realm of legality. What is in the realm of ethics today will perhaps at some stage in the future move into the realm of legality. In other words, ethics is, at this point in time, perhaps voluntary. In some sense, it's optional. It's not legal, right? But if you are ethical, you will always be legal because ethics is beyond legality. And ethics is what makes people get excited about you because they know that they can trust you. They know they can have a long-term relationship with you.
I want to talk more about the specifics of the software industry and the model that you've developed, but I can't resist asking a question about the ideas you raise about equality and fairness, and everyone brings data to the table on, you know, entitled to a chance to be an equal partner in an enterprise. And India obviously has a history of a caste system and very sort of divided hierarchy in society.
Sure.
And how does that affect what you're trying to do, and what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, obviously it's a big challenge because the mindset is one of hierarchy, the mindset is one of caste system. We also went through colonization, so in that sense, it again is another barrier. But I have realized that if you collect a team of youngsters, if you set rules that will benefit the team as a whole, if you are transparent about those rules, if you ensure that everybody knows how, by following those rules, they will become better and the community will become better, people start accepting these paradigms very easily. So the important thing to do is to bring transparency, bring openness, bring clarity to the new set of rules that you want to implement in any organization. And once you do that, people accept it, and the mindset gets changed quickly.
We're talking this morning with N.R. Narayana Murthy. He's chairman of the board and chief mentor at Infosys Technologies in Bangalore, India. And he's here on the campus to speak at Fullinger Auditorium. And actually, this is a pre-recorded interview, so that will have occurred by the time you hear this. But he's speaking on the topic of the Indian software industry, managing change and growth in the knowledge economy. This is, as I mentioned, a pre-recorded interview, so we can't take your calls on the air this morning. We hope that you get a lot of value by simply listening to us talk. You obtained your master's degree from the Indian Institute of Technology, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell us about the IIT and about its impact on India's technology industries?
You know, IITs have done a decent job in providing good quality undergraduate education. However, they have a big challenge in making themselves world-class in graduate education, in research, in making sure that the number of papers that they produce is pretty good, in making sure that their citation index is high, etc. So I would say while on the one side they have done a good job in undergraduate education, I think in the areas of undergraduate research, graduate research, I think they still have some work to do.
Well, I certainly hear from a lot of people that India seems to have more than its share of people very talented at mathematics and science. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Given the fact that we are a large country, a nation of 1 billion people, given the fact that we have had a culture which revered science, mathematics, physics, astronomy, etc., you know, as early as 580, mm-hmm. Given that the middle class in every culture focuses on education as an instrument for salvation, instrument for betterment, and given that we have a large middle class, which is about 150 million to 200 million people, no wonder at all that India has a large pool of talent.
I want to ask you to talk a bit about globalization. It seems to be one of those words that have different meanings to different people, and it's used a great deal by the media without really defining it. What do you think about the meaning of globalization?
Well, to me, globalization is about sourcing capital from where it is cheapest, sourcing talent from where it is best available, producing where it is most cost-effective, and selling where the markets are without being constrained by national boundaries, which means that in the globalized world, companies compete on the basis of their uniqueness, on the basis of the products and services that they bring to the global bazaar, on the basis of the quality and the productivity that they demonstrate in providing value to the customers. In other words, it creates a plethora of choices. The whole globe is your arena. You can buy the best product from anywhere in the world. In other words, it helps you go beyond the national boundaries, and it helps you become that much more competitive in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Many Americans have been very concerned about the loss of jobs in the United States as a result of the globalization process, and especially about outsourcing and offshoring in the information technology sector. What would you say about those concerns?
You know, you're talking about concerns about outsourcing or concerns
sure.
about...
Yeah, loss of jobs, obviously okay. directly yeah. affecting yeah. those whose jobs are lost, and sort of they feel it most acutely.
Well, it is inevitable that there will be some loss of jobs when you want to become globally competitive, because you will have to source expertise, talent, products, and services from the best company in the globe. But that also means the consumers are getting the best value for money from the corporation. Let me give you a very simple example. Now, today when I get up in the morning, I go to my fridge, which is a LG fridge, which is a South Korean fridge. We in India had our own refrigerator company. They were pretty good. But they couldn't compete in the marketplace with the LGs and others and GE, etc. That meant loss of jobs because a lot of components get imported. Second, I opened my fridge and see Coca-Cola, Pepsi, etc. We do had our own soft drink companies, but they couldn't stand the might of the marketing might of Coke and Pepsi. That meant loss of jobs. And I use my Toyota car to go to my office. We had our own automobile industry, but that again couldn't compete with the Toyotas and the Fords and the GMs. I used to have a GM car before. That again meant loss of jobs. Then in the office, I use a Dell computer. That we had our own computer industry, but that again, that got shut down because the volumes were not there, the economies of scale were not there. So that also meant loss of jobs. Now, I can take the view that the entry of LGs and the Fords and the Dells has resulted in loss of jobs of probably 1 million or 2 in India. So we should keep them out. On the other hand, I can look at how the 200 or 300 million middle-class Indians have actually benefited because these companies have given better value for money to them. These companies have brought better products to them, and then say, is this good or bad? I think a solution that has benefited 300 million people, while a couple of million perhaps have suffered temporarily, is obviously a better solution. But what is happening is that these couple of million people are finding jobs in other parts of the economy. So it is very, very easy to throw the baby with the bathwater by saying that globalization, outsourcing, etc., has resulted in some job losses. But I would suggest that people who are being made redundant, they have to be utilized in other parts of the corporation, particularly in customer-facing activities and in activities where the local talent is needed. And that's where the CEOs have to think very carefully and make sure that the corporation becomes more and more competitive while ensuring that these people who are made redundant in one part of the organization are indeed absorbed in other parts of the organization.
One of the other primary concerns of those critical of globalization, especially in terms of labor, is that it places great downward pressure on wages in certain cases. This is especially evident in certain sectors of consumer manufacturing, for example, in the garment industry, where companies have relocated to companies with the lowest possible wages and perhaps little in the way of labor protection laws and things like that. What do you think about that as an issue in terms of the balance of you know, who wins and loses in globalization? Are you concerned about that?
Sure. You know, I think I am concerned in the sense, being a global citizen, I am concerned about fairness. I am concerned about the interests of the poor, there is no doubt at all. But we must realize that we cannot judge every situation from the perspective of one group. We have to take an integrated perspective. While it is true that when you look at it from the perspective of the U.S., some of the companies that produce the apparel, you know, and shoes, etc., are not following the finest principles of employee welfare when you look at it from the U.S. perspective. But at the same time, instead of saying we will not deal with those companies, we will not deal with those governments, the better model would be to help them understand what the best practices in the world are and then make them adapt those. I think if we did that, everybody would be a winner. The corporations will get best value for money. The consumers in the developed countries will get the best products at the best prices. And the employees in those companies, in those countries, will also be better off. I would say we have to take a very, very moderate view of these things.
I believe you have used the phrase compassionate capitalism. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that term?
Oh, by that what I mean is I firmly believe in capitalism because capitalism is about opportunity to make life better for oneself, opportunity to create wealth, opportunity to create enterprises, create jobs, etc., without being constrained by the governmental whims and fancies. So capitalism is good. But at the same time, we have to ensure that there is fairness to the less fortunate in the society. We have to make sure that the corporations continue to have the goodwill of the community, continue to live in harmony with the context, which means they have to make a difference to the context. Their policies will have to realize that the community indeed has to benefit as the corporation prospers. So it's summing up in a simpler way, it is about capitalism in the mind. It's about socialism at heart.
I've read that you were very much influenced by Nehru's idea of socialism, but after spending 10 years or so in Europe, sort of changed your views on that particular, at least that style of socialism. I guess I want to ask, what values do you retain from the sort of Nehru school of socialism, that ideal, if that's the appropriate way to frame it?
Well, you know, George Bernard Shaw once said, if you're not an idealist in your 20s, you have no heart. If you're an idealist in your 40s, you have no brain. I think that's too strong a statement, because at the end of the day, idealism should never die in the heart of anybody. Whether you're 20 or 100, it's idealism that fires your imagination. It's idealism that sustains your hope for the betterment of the future, etc., etc. So what I continue to respect in Nehruvian socialism is a sense of balance, a sense of fairness between the haves and the have-nots, a desire to look at how every one of our decisions is not a zero-sum game, but a positive-sum game wherein everybody benefits. A paradigm wherein the urban India and the rural India both make decent progress. A paradigm where every child in every part of the world has access to better education, better health care, better nutrition, etc., better shelter, etc. So I would say these things. But the main difference is I'm convinced today that you cannot solve the problem of poverty by rhetoric. You cannot solve the problem of poverty by distributing wealth. You cannot solve the problem of poverty by making the richer guys poorer. You can only solve the problem of poverty by creating more jobs, by creating more jobs with more disposable incomes. You can only solve the problem of poverty by encouraging entrepreneurship. That's the primary difference, and that's what capitalism is all about.
That's a very interesting answer, and I wonder what you would say to those who think that the business of business is simply to make money. I believe you said, and I read somewhere, that you think it's the task of business to create more and more employment, and I suppose, you know, wealth along with that. But there is a school of thought, especially in American capitalism, that says corporation is there to earn money for the shareholders, and that's basically their sole obligation.
Well, you know, I mean, I have tremendous respect for Professor Milton Friedman. I've learned a lot. I've read a lot of his writings. And he's a purist, and he would say corporations should worry about shareholder value maximization. While not taking away from the thoughts of such an extraordinary intellectual, I would only apply it to a context that we see today in the world, whether it's India, US, etc. And that is, if you want your corporation to maximize shareholder value, then you have to ensure that you have the goodwill of the community. You have to ensure that your employees are happy with you. You have to ensure that your customers are happy with you. You have to ensure that your investors are happy with you. You cannot shortchange any one of these people and create long-term value for the shareholders. And in doing so, you have to take up some aspects of corporate social responsibility, because at the end of the day, it's the community that's supplying talent for you, for your corporation to add greater and greater value to investors. And if that is so, then if you want better and better talent to come from your community, then you have to make a difference to that community. Similarly, if you want the best employees to work for you, then you have to have fairness, openness, transparency, meritocracy, etc., etc.
That kind of leads to the question I was going to ask you next. Someone suggested I should ask you about the corporate culture at Infosys. How would you describe it, and what do you value most as a company?
Well, you know, we are a very open community. We are a meritocracy. We believe that our smartness is a function of how we recruit people who are smarter than us. We believe in transparency. We believe in fairness. We benchmark ourselves with the best global companies in everything that we do. We use speed, imagination, and excellence in execution in everything that we do. We believe that youth is all about future, because youth is all about energy, enthusiasm, and excellence in everything that it does. So we leverage the power of youth more and more in everything that we do. And we respect, and we do not shortchange any of our stakeholders.
We're talking this morning on Focus 580 with N.R. Narayana Murthy. He's chairman of the board and chief mentor at Infosys Technologies in Bangalore, India. And he was here on the campus of the University of Illinois to speak the Arnold O. Beckman Lecture in Science and Innovation at Fullinger Auditorium. And this was an event in the past. By the time you hear this broadcast, this is a pre-recorded conversation. So, alas, we cannot take your calls during this hour of Focus 580. So we'll just carry on here. I do want to follow up on the issue of the notion of compassionate capitalism and corporate governance, and ask you a question about the influence of Wall Street in India. How big a factor in corporate governance is Wall Street at Infosys? Does the Wall Street, it seems like it has a bias for short-term performance in terms of returns to shareholders. Does that conflict with the need for long-term growth and economic development in India?
No, I today we live in an interconnected global village. We're listed on NASDAQ. So we have to follow the requirements of NASDAQ, which is quarterly results, which is focus on the earnings per share. I believe that as long as you have a clear value system, as long as you have a clear long-term goal, your focus on the short term will not affect those goals, because at the end of the day, a series of short terms make the long term. And as long as the road is very clear, the direction is very clear, the faster you run, the more checkpoints that you have, more often you have the checkpoints, it's all right. I don't see anything wrong with that.
Well, and certainly Infosys has performed very well in terms of, you know, the stock market since you've gone public. I think you've had you've never had a quarter where the shareholder price has gone down. Is that correct?
Well, let me put it this way. We have this principle of under-promise, over-deliver. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in the, I'll tell you, it's 26 or 27 quarters since we got listed on NASDAQ.
Yeah.
We always delivered on our promise. Similarly, in the 49 or so quarters that we have been listed in India, we have always delivered on our promise, because to us, delivering on promise is extremely important. That's all about trust. It's all about our DNA. So we have done that.
Less than 2 weeks ago came the news that the Dutch company ABN AMRO signed contracts with Infosys and two other Indian software companies and some others to outsource most of its information technology. The Wall Street Journal suggests an increasing amount of your future growth will come from Asia, Latin America, and Europe. I'm curious, will the U.S. be less important as these other markets develop?
No, I don't think U.S. will be less important, because this is the most dynamic market. This is the most innovative market. This is the most competitive market. If we want to be fighting fit, if we want to grow faster, then we have to be significant players in this market. This is also a market where we can attract the best talent in the world, so there is no doubt at all. So U.S. is a very important market. If we want the best investors, then this is the market. So on all counts, U.S. will be the primary blip on our radar screen. Absolutely.
What about China? I note that India and China are developing closer ties. What do you see in terms of the potential of the Chinese market?
Well, you know, we already have an operation in Shanghai.
Yeah.
We believe that as a company that wants to grow faster and faster, as a company that is becoming more and more global, we have to have a presence in China. At this point in time, we are using China more as a development center. I'm sure as we move forward, we will look at the local market. China is again has large talent pool like India. Of course, at this point in time, China has some negatives compared to India, in the sense, one, while they are technically pretty good, their knowledge of English is not as good as we would like. Number two, the project management skills are in short supply. Number three, because of a certain form of government, the understanding of business amongst the Chinese youngsters is still not very good. Mm-hmm. But they're all issues that can be sorted out over a period of time. I am not that much worried.
You've noted that the regulatory climate in India, when that was liberalized and opened up, that made a tremendous difference in your ability to operate. Do you see those barriers in other countries that perhaps, you know, disadvantage them in terms of, you know, your kind of enterprise? Or are things changing quickly?
In the services sector, I think we do see still many, many areas where China is behind India in the services sector. But the good thing about China is that they are in a hurry to change them. We have been in discussions with them, and I do believe that the Chinese will change. But at this point in time, they are behind India.
I know you place a great emphasis on the work ethic. I'm very curious about this. I read in one article you see less emphasis in the West on the work ethic these days. Can you offer any criticism about the West or the United States, if you don't mind, if of a constructive nature or otherwise, in terms of what we should be doing for ourselves in the world?
You know, I'm a great admirer of the U.S., so it's very, very difficult for me to criticize the U.S. I don't know of any other society which is as open as this country. I don't know of any other society where, irrespective of your caste, creed, religion, color, whatever it is, people measure you by what you bring to the table. I don't know of any other society that has been able to attract the best talent from different parts of the world as U.S. has done. So it is very difficult for me to criticize U.S. I really don't. And on the best proof of that is that my children, both of them are studying here. My son is starting his PhD at Harvard, and my daughter is doing her MBA at Stanford. You know, what more testimonial can there be for my respect for this society than that?
I understand. That certainly makes a lot of sense. I'm still curious about, especially in recent times, the United States has been pushing for liberalization of global trade, you know, by participating in the WTO and so forth. In recent years, there has been more criticism about our track record. And I guess I'm curious if you think the United States has been a fair player in global trade over the last several years, and what would you hope the U.S. would do to be a good partner in the global economy?
Well, you know, we must realize that the government policies should not be confused with people. From, you know, time to time, government policies change based on the economic situation, based on the trade situation, etc., etc. But having said all the good things about the U.S., because I believe that U.S. is the leader in the world today, is perhaps the best leader in the world today, there is much greater responsibility on the shoulders of U.S. to show fairness, to show equity in everything that it does compared to any other nation. Because it is the most powerful nation, it is much more important for U.S. to be seen as more generous than others, to be seen as fairer than others. In that sense, possibly, it'll be a lot better for the credibility of the U.S., for the faith that all of us have in the U.S., that U.S. follows policies that demonstrate their desire to walk the talk.
Shifting the topic a little bit, I'd like to explore your thoughts about the direction of computer technology and software, since that's the core of your enterprise. Do you have some particular ideas about how the rapid evolution of computer technology will affect our economies, our knowledge sectors, and our cultures in the coming years?
Well, you know, thanks to Internet, today you have, in some sense, conquered distance, you conquered time zones. You know, sitting in Champagne this morning, I could read all the Indian newspapers on the net. My children and I, you know, my wife and I on one side, my children on the other side, we participate in the instant messaging, thanks to, you know, and have chat sessions. Similarly, Infosys, being a virtual organization, having offices and development centers in different parts of the world, we work seamlessly thanks to technology. So technology has already played a very, very important role in bringing different cultures together, in bringing the concept of globalization as a viable concept, in making sure that international trade becomes more efficient, all of that. But as we move forward, we would move to what I would call ubiquitous computing. Just as electricity is available wherever you go today, and in different forms. You've got the batteries, you've got all the plugs and all of that, sockets. Similarly, access to information, access to databases will be available on a ubiquitous basis thanks to broadband wireless, thanks to miniaturization, thanks to increasing computing power, thanks to nanotechnology, etc. What will happen in the years to come would be we will move to what I would term mobile decision making. As in the earlier days, it was always the desktop decision making. That is, in other words, a manager needed to sit down in front of his or her desktop to take decisions because he or she had access to information. I think that will go away, and the managers will be able to access huge databases, corporate databases. They will be able to run huge analytical tools and come to conclusions, come to decisions on a mobile basis. The only drawback I see in the model that I think of is the size of the screen, because the PDAs that we use are all very small. You know, I gave a lecture a couple of months ago in a school in Bangalore, and I said how we would get to mobile decision making, and I talked about the constraint of the size of the screen. One of the youngsters stood up and said, look, I don't see that's a constraint, because he said what will happen in the near future is that those PDAs will project into the space a certain screen size, whatever, 15 inch or 16 inch that you want, which only you can see and nobody else in the world can see, because it's based on the angle at which you're looking, based on your biometric, whatever it is, characteristics. So it's fully secure, but only you are looking at a screen in the space. Right. So that becomes a projector. So it's quite possible. I think something like that is likely to happen.
I found it really interesting. I found an interview you conducted with Danny Hillis, one of the pioneers in parallel processing.
I thought
it was a very interesting interview. The two of you spoke about what's ahead in technology. And I'm curious, you know, you're trained as an engineer. That's your background before you became, a leader of a corporation. Do you have some personal interests in particular aspects of technology?
Boy, I mean, I must have the latest gadget in everything. There is no doubt at all. In fact, a couple of my colleagues and I, we are all the time competing as to who has the latest stuff. My personal interest in technology is it should make my life more comfortable. It should make me more productive. And hopefully it should also help me have good entertainment, music and movies, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, that's at a personal level. And technology does all of that, so.
We have about 3 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about leadership. Since you are one who has demonstrated great success as a leader, I wonder if you could talk a bit about the qualities of leadership. What makes someone a great leader?
Somebody asked me, how do you say a leader is great? I said, a great leader is one in whose presence everybody feels an inch taller. In other words, a leader's primary objective is to raise the aspirations of people. It is about making people more confident. It is about raising the self-esteem of people. It is about making people dream big stuff. It is about making people accept the adage, a plausible impossibility is better than a convincing possibility. It is about the best definition of leadership was given by George Bernard Shaw, and I think Robert Kennedy used it once, and he said, Most people see things as they are and wonder why. I dream of things that never won't say why not. I think that sums up leadership.
Last question. You are quoted as saying that the new rich must live simply, even austerely, if capitalism is to become an accepted model for social betterment.
Yeah.
Do you still live simply?
Well, that's for others to judge, but I can tell you that I live in the same house that I've been living in for the last 19 years. My wife and I, we lead a fairly simple life. I still drive a Toyota Corolla, and before that I used to drive a GM, one of those cars I have, and simple ones. Yes, certainly, yes. We lead, compared to what people expect my lifestyle to be, I do think that I lead a simpler life.
Well, we'll have to leave it there since we're out of time. Our guest has been N.R. Narayana Murthy, Chairman of the Board and Chief Mentor of Infosys Technologies in Bangalore, India. He was visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give the Arnold O. Beckman Lecture at the Fullinger Auditorium, and we had an opportunity to have him in the studio. Alas, this was not a live interview, which was preempted by the John Roberts confirmation hearings, but we wanted to provide this for listeners because of the great interest in hearing from Mr. Murthy. Mr. Murthy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.